Starman by David Bowie, of course, and I wonder how many times that's been played on the radio. Classic Rock magazine says of my next guest, when a Paul Trinker book cover boasts the word definitive, it's a claim you can pretty much take to the bank. Such is the claim for Starman. Has there ever been a more charismatic and intriguing rock star than David Bowie? In Starman, Paul Trinker has painted the definitive portrait of this great artist. From Bowie's early years in post-war bombed-out Brixton, to the bacchanalian glamour of Ziggy Stardust, to the controversial but vital Berlin period, this brilliant biography is a celebration of Bowie and a timely reminder of how great music is made. Paul, good afternoon.
Hi, Kit.
Thanks very much for joining us and welcome to TRE. I want to just take a passage from the introduction to the biography, and I'm struck by your portrayal of Bowie singing Starman, which we've just heard, on Top of the Pops in July 1972. And I can actually remember watching this clearly, and you recapture it beautifully. You say that casually and coolly Bowie places his arm around Mick Ronson's neck, pulls him lovingly towards him, and then there's the same octave leap as he sings the chorus again, but this time it doesn't suggest leaping the bounds of earth. It symbolizes escaping the bounds of sexuality. And then there's this lovely bit where you talk about outraged parents leaving the room, and I can remember my dad was one of those. My dad would sort of linger around Top of the Pops to see Pan's People. Did you have one of those Thursdays at 7:30? Sort of older people would be very keen on Pan. Do you remember Pan's People?
I do, yes.
And but my point is, let me get to my point. You then say that up to this period, pop music had been about belonging, about identification, and that this performance was a spectacle of not belonging. What do you mean by that?
I think it's a celebration of coming from somewhere else, being on your own, being a star man coming from another place. It was a celebration of the other, of lonely people, you know. So it wasn't... pop music has always been very collective and anthemic, and this song presses all those buttons. You know, Starman is kind of a rewrite of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and it is about people stuck out in Kansas who are on their own, who've got to make their own way through the world. And Bowie did have that effect on people. It's people in little villages who were drawn towards him. You know, so every town or place, if you were a Bowie fan, you were often on your own. That's what made him special. He described himself as the world's biggest cult artist, and certainly in this period he was. You know, it was a statement of being different, of being the other, if you went for that. You know, you could, it's not as simple, but you can also compare it to just being, you know, to being gay. And obviously, you know, in those days there'd be one gay in the village, and he was identifying with those people, the people on their own, the individuals.
Pansexuality, it was so radical. And you, we were kind of flailing around for any category comfort zone, and we'd never seen anything like it.
Well, it was, as so often, he got the timing exactly right. It was in the air. People were talking about it. I think actually Mark Bolan was talking in the press about how if he saw a man that he fancied, he'd go up and kiss him. But the thing about Bowie, if he committed himself, he went all the way. And as with Mark, he'd play with these ideas and he'd experiment with things, but Bowie would commit himself and go all the way. You know, he'd finish, he'd provide all the finishing touches, and he had a lot of courage in that kind of way. So, you know, famously, before that appearance, he was interviewed by Melody Maker and said, you know, I'm gay and I always have been, even when I was David Jones. And I mean, perhaps in retrospect that was something of a red herring, but it was a very powerful statement about being the other and having a kind of courage just to go out there and say, you know, this is me, I'm different to anybody else.
Yes,
take all of me, here we are.
So I'm going to come on to his later stages and how he changed and reinvented himself, but possibly his first invention was the most, the invention around Starman was the most profound. It was the one that really made people sit up and notice.
That's true. Although the one thing I would say is before he created all these persona, he created David Bowie himself. That's what people often yes. overlook, that he was a kid who was had a lot of charm and had had a real facility, had a confidence, but he wasn't really a great singer when he started out, and he wasn't necessarily a great frontman, and he certainly wasn't a great songwriter, but he taught himself, and it's a very arduous process of constructing this whole David Bowie, just the songwriter, the craftsman, before he overlaid these persona on top of it. And I think that aspect of his genius tends to be underrated. You know, yeah. he didn't jump out of the womb sure. as a talented songwriter, and I think that pained him.
Tell us a bit about the early days.
Mark Bolan, who came to it all naturally, he had to work really hard. Yeah. That meant,
he struggled, didn't he?
In a way, his talent was all the more versatile and deeper, I think.
He struggled, didn't he, in the early days? I mean, if it was Starman that really, really broke him. Tell us about the early days, because he wrote some fairly unprepossessing albums to start with.
Well, he wrote a lot of songs. He went through a lot of record labels. He could charm people into getting these great record deals. And there's a chap called Hugh Mendel, who was one of the big cheeses at Decca. And David just charmed him and convinced him that he was a real boy genius. And Hugh still had this kind of lingering fascination with him, even while admitting the music just wasn't really that good. But the whole thing about the young David Bowie, as he was, he just kept working at it all the time. And, you know, there's a great lesson there for all of us. You just have to put the hours in. So he started off by ripping off different people, something terrible. And in many cases, his songs were kind of cut and paste from other people's songs. You know, it'll be a bit of a King's idea for the chorus and then a straight lift of a Who chord sequence. For the chorus, you know, and the Kinks for the verse.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Somewhere Over the Rainbow just now. Starman, I can't hear that. Can you sing that?
Somewhere over the rainbow, there's a starman waiting in the sky.
Okay, so I thought of White Cliffs of Dover. I thought there'll be bluebirds over the.
That was a rip off of the same song as well, very consciously with a similar chord sequence. But by now, you know, David's doing it, and he's, you know, that's a knowing reference. You know, it's not just. By now, he's gone beyond just. Ripping off other people. He's just transmuting this stuff. And the thing about that song as well is he'd recorded most of the Ziggy album. That was done differently from anything else he'd done before. It was all kind of rehearsed up as a band album just down the road, just in my manor, just in a little in the basement of what is now a little pharmacy in Greenwich. And then the record company said, great album, you know, but we need a single. And he just sat down and wrote it. And the music was pouring out of him. And it just shows that if you can transform yourself into an artistic being, and then again, that's magical as well. You know, the whole essence of being able to kind of transcend the limitations of what we're born with, and become a great songwriter when you maybe didn't start out as one.
Yeah.
Well, it's an incredible transformation. So I think Bowie's one of those people when actually the more you learn about him, the more fascinating he is.
Mm. Let's just go back to the plagiarism, because that for me, reading some of your book. And obviously, I must admit, I haven't read it all. The paradox for me was that an album like Hunky Dory was just completely original. I mean, the fact that he relegated the electric guitar, which was absolutely the genre of 1970, to the background and brought Rick Wakeman in on keyboards, that to me smacked of extraordinary originality. And yet, in you know, one of the lyrics of Changes is that he calls himself a faker. I am surprised by this plagiarism, though.
Well, firstly, picking out Hunky Dory is a good one because, again, he transformed himself. You know, he wrote songs in a particular way, playing the guitar in a particular style. And then suddenly with Angie at his side, he taught himself to write in a completely different way and just kind of broke through a lot of barriers, a lot of creative barriers, and learned to write in a different style with a different kind of chord sequence. And again, it's not very often that you see people dropping all the old techniques and coming up with new ones. And this is really early on in his career. Maybe it was desperation. I don't think it was. I think by then he just had this momentum and this incredible self-belief, and the people around him were never in any doubt that it was going to happen. But in terms of plagiarism itself, I had a lot of trouble with the lawyers from my book company who'd said, well, you're accusing him of plagiarism. And I said, well, this is show business. You know, you take what you can from other people, and it's a fast-moving, you know, if you're just ripping off other people and you're not doing it a new way, you know, you'll get so far. But in his case, it goes beyond that. There's a kind of alchemical quality towards it as well. And of course, in another sense, he's doing what Andy Warhol was, you know, appropriation. You quote somebody and it gives you this kind of extra depth of references. And so it's, you know, as long as you're acknowledging what you're doing, then it's not theft, is it? And I think in the early days he did, you know, lift a few chord sequences here and there and claim they were in his own. But by the time of Hunky Dory, whatever he's taking, you can see, you know, and he's in Hunky Dory, he's talking about Bob Dylan. He's addressing him. He's kind of consciously name-checking him to set up these resonances to challenge him and to also show that he likes him. You know, he's in awe of him at the same time. And he was always very, very open about that, and that's kind of part of his enthusiasm as well. But certainly, you know, there's a lot of go right to the, you know, check out the sources, because he listened to a lot of people, and in the early days he was kind of gauche the way he'd quote them. And then by the time of Starman, you know, it's all there. You can see exactly what he's doing, and in a way that makes it all the more beautiful and original.
Hunky Dory from the heart and Ziggy Moore from the head.
I think that's probably true, yes. I think, but to some extent, you can't talk about one without the other. I think he had all those songs more or less together at the same time. So at the same time he would improvise a lot, he also used to think about the bigger picture. So I think even when he was making Hunky Dory, he knew he was going to make a Balls to the Wall guitar album, and he had a lot of those songs that were inspired from when he, you know, went over to the States and heard the Stooges for the first time and became obsessed with them, and, you know, would rip off a lot of Iggy songs, you know. Yeah. Obviously Iggy was a reference for Ziggy as well, but at the same time, when you read the reviews for Ziggy Stardust, most people didn't like it. Reviewers just said, oh, it sounds, the sounds review was, this sounds like the work of a competent plagiarist. So it shows you how much critics know, because it wasn't really about, you know, what he ripped off, it's what he did with it. You know, the influences are irrelevant. It's the end result that matters.
And the third in the salvo, the holy trinity of Bowie albums in the early 70s, Aladdin Sane.
Yeah, a wonderful album. Again, you know, we have Mike Garson, the fantastic pianist there as well, who adds this kind of edge to the whole thing. And in many ways, that's my favourite of that trio, because it's just a little bit more unleashed. You know, it doesn't have necessarily the consistency, but in terms of the moments, it's just the most out there. And, you know, it's not as... We have all the kind of intellectuality, but then we have this kind of weird, surreal edge, which comes from a man who was himself, you know, much more on the edge. You know, he was more or less being toured to death. He was basically accumulating all these incredibly new experiences, but it, you know, it's a lot more out there than anything else he'd done to date.
Just going back to his writing, is it true that his lyrics were randomly fused together on a tabletop with cut-out newspaper headlines?
I would, certainly not early on. You know, I think he heard, and this is all from a technique developed by Brian Dyson and William Burroughs, a cut-up technique, and he would talk about it a lot. And certainly he said he was doing it for Diamond Dogs, and actually I think you can see that technique used in Diamond Dogs, which is a little more dystopian, to, you know, to use a cliched phrase, but, you know, it certainly was. And then later on he learned how to do, he saw Iggy making up lyrics on the spot, and so again he'd come up with new techniques where on Heroes rather than just go in the studio with a considered lyric, he'd sing a verse, then he'd just sit there and write another verse or another line, then sing that verse or line. So it was just fresh and immediate, because again, he was trying to find different ways of doing the same thing, a different way of approaching his art. And that is, you know, what is great about the man, because he didn't really ever sit down on his laurels and say, I've learned how to do it, this is how you write a song.
Yes.
If you think about somebody like, say, Keith Richards, bless him, you know, it's kind of like, this is how you write a song, I start with this, then we do that, and it's, you know, they're wonderful. But they come, you basically know what you're going to get, and with Bowie, you sense that sometimes he doesn't know what he's going to get, and that's what we want, really, isn't it?
Yes, although earlier in the programme we played Fill Your Heart, and I think that's, for me, that's pure poetry. That is the secret of freedom, that song. And I get the feeling that is a properly crafted poem.
Well, yeah, he was influenced by a lot of because Biff Rowe song, and you know, he's an incredible kind of collector of all this stuff, and a curator of lots of different things as well, but there's also this kind of childishness at the heart of it all as well, so it's not all incredibly
playfulness,
you know, sophisticated. You know, I like the childlike element of him. You know, he was a good babysitter, you know, he was kind of very sincere, and at the same time there is this artifice and this knowing, you know, at the same time you've got somebody's got this fantastic just boyish enthusiasm for stuff. Mm-hmm. And in some ways he's quite a conventional family man, as we're seeing now. So, you know, he's
A
very
So anyone who knows anything about David Bowie knows his chameleon ability for self-reinvention. You call it repositioning the brand.
Yes.
I mean, is there a strategic connection here? I mean, how cold-blooded was this? For example, the breakup of the Spiders. Was that repositioning, or was that genuine?
In rock music, I mean, the thing is that it's unusual, and was it cold-blooded? Perhaps. Was it necessary? Yes. But there are very few people who can be as brutal with themselves as well as other musicians as that. But it is the case that when you speak to people who knew him at the time, they use this kind of language. There's a chap called Di Davies who later managed the Stranglers and did press for David at a time, would spend long evenings just talking early into the morning about just ideas. And only then, you know, did he say he realised that Bowie was repositioning the brand. He knew what a brand was even before that term had been coined, really, in popular music, and about, you know, rebadging himself. And he had, you know, he did read a lot about advertising and talks about a lot of those kind of ideas. Mm-hmm. And yes, he was. You know, he had a consciousness of just the bigger picture, you know, of when he went on tour for Station to Station, he'd check all the transparencies just to, you know, that they sent out to people before they went out, you know. So there was this amazing attention to detail. But also, we have somebody who's not really control freak. He'll work with musicians and be very, very free. So it's an interesting combination. But yes, there is a innate understanding of himself as a brand. And that sounds like a bad thing, you know, because we are, you know, we think of it as being cynical. But it's going to happen one way or the other. So you need to control it yourself in order to get what you want out of there, because really, record companies, producers, they tend to water down what we want, you know, and make it more conservative. So I think you have to be more sophisticated in terms of your understanding of the business, like he was, to get across what you want to do.
And Paul, you make the point in your book that each brand renewal, each metamorphosis, came at a cost. What do you mean by that?
Well, because it's just hard work. It's, you know, it takes this immense psychic energies just to drop everything you've done before and live outside your comfort zone. And why did he do all that?
Do you think somehow that some of the changes lacked foundation, that they lacked some sort of belief, that they were for effect?
Oh, in general, no. I think I think those profound changes were probably more sincere than most things we've seen in pop music. You know, where somebody gets told by their record company they need to stick a disco beat in there. You know, he went for it all the way. But you can't do that kind of thing forever. And you know, nobody. You know, he couldn't sustain a perfect recording career forever. And you know, there were certainly a couple of dreadful tours, and you know, I've certainly seen things like Tin Machine, and you know, with a band that I loved, you know, with very, very talented musicians. And, you know, he wouldn't, you know, I'm sure he's still proud of it, and there are good songs in there, but generally they were pretty awful. And, but the thing about that is David could always walk away, and the other guys couldn't necessarily. You know, there have been other, you know, in terms of the whole MTV look that he went for, where he, you know, had his little beard, and then he's suddenly hanging out with Dave Grohl. I didn't, you know, I wasn't as convinced by those as I was by some of his earlier metamorphoses. But then again, you know, it's a musician's job to do what they want, and there aren't necessarily mistakes. Everything you do is a kind of a learning. So, but I'd say he's more sincere than people think. And by the way, sounding like I'm writing this as if it's some kind of hagiography, and I'm not, because there are, you know, the many things he did that where if you lived with him, you'd find him very difficult as a person. But I think with the art itself and the music in general, there is a kind of a purity. And that's a great thing about, you know, musicians. When you're doing a biography, you realise other people do get chewed up, you know, they get thrown out, and that's quite difficult. But a good musician, it's often worthwhile when you end up with good music.
Paul, as his biographer, can I ask you, what is your favourite Bowie e-book?
Oh, for me, unmistakably Low, I think, because I remember that period very well, I can remember how sort of striking it was, just that air of mystery of sort of disappearing.
Well, that was important for you and your life, was it?
Well, and I think even now that music just really stands up. I think the Ziggy period stands up today because they're just really good songs and good performances, but the Low recordings are still radical today. They were the first to mix together this kind of American soul and funk with an electronic top end, and although there's a lot of personal difficulty and angst around the recording, there's a kind of optimism as well that pop music, you know, we can do new stuff, this fantastic sense of discovery.
What are the go-to tracks on Low? What are the go-to tracks on Low? It's not an album I know.
Oh, with Sound and Vision, always Crushing in the Same Car. Okay. Be My Wife is a really lovely one, and that's great because that was written after a massive argument with Angie, where they'd been throwing stuff at each other. She was something of a drama queen, and she would turn. You know, they wouldn't see each other for ages, and there'd always be drama around, and they had massive arguments. And there's lots of debates about the meaning of that song, but I think, you know, it's not to Angie, you know, let's stay together. I think it's kind of like, I want somebody normal, you know, be my wife, you know, just actually extolling a normal marriage. And of course, to some extent, he never wanted a normal marriage because he wanted his freedom. But to other extents, I think he was a fairly conventional guy, as we can see now, you know, with him taking his daughter to school, and he's earned the right to be a normal bloke after all.
He's probably really enjoying it. So you don't concur with my opinion, and possibly I'm a bit older than you, I don't know, but the holy trinity of Hunky Dory, Ziggy and Aladdin Sane, those having been delivered, apart from the odd peak, there's a feeling that Bowie has been a bit like the Spanish Empire, a sort of meandering decline of contrived reinventions ever since.
His 80s were fairly dull. What happened was he wanted to become a mainstream artist, and suddenly having learned that, you know, the secret of success is turning left when everybody else is turning right, and suddenly he started turning right so he's hanging out with Tina Turner, and kind of his songs had always been plucked out of the air and recorded really quickly, and then what he started doing was making demos, and the demos would be perfect, then he'd re-record an even more perfect version of the demo, and that was the opposite of the working method that had, you know, been really successful for him. So he'd just become conventional. He had hung out with probably just too many wealthy people, all, you know, successful people. He was hanging around, you know, Mick Jagger and Tina Turner, and those things do have an effect. But all I can say is, you know, listen to Mick Jagger's solo albums from that period, and they're damn sight worse than David's.
Okay, a bit of a communal trough there. Bowie in Berlin, the thin white duke. Is there a sinister fascism underlying this phase?
I think he was unhealthily obsessed. He'd been through this cocaine period in Los Angeles, and I had one of his friends who hung out with him there would say how he'd just be locked watching World War II newsreels for 48 hours at a stretch, and he was going into a very strange mental place. But I think, and equally, when he was around, he also did come out with some pretty horrible pro-fascist sentiments as well. But he did apologise, and I think it's just that ego that many people have when every utterance of yours has been treated as being incredibly profound, and you suddenly start, you're coming up with all these controversial statements. He just went too far, but I think he realised later on how wrong he was. I don't really think he was ever a kind of a racist person in the way that some of his peers certainly were, but he was playing with a lot of those ideas of the Third Reich, of Hitler being the greatest showman, and other people had basically flaunted the same kind of statement, but it was unhealthy. But
it was a phase. We can forgive him that.
Cocaine will do that to you. You think you're coming up with the most profound statements and you're just talking gibberish. And I think, he was on his own a lot, you want to say.
Yes. And the music of that period, what was that? What were the an album that was
phenomenal? Well, Station to Station is one where he was the most on the edge. And then we're at kind of Low and Heroes on The Lodger. And those are a man who's kind of working out how, again, his place in the world anew, and they are wonderful works, really. And I know he thinks about that period in Berlin in quite a nostalgic way, but I think it was an amazing time, and I don't think we'll ever see the likes of that in pop music again. I mean, can you imagine somebody who's had these number one records with things like Fame and just disappears to a European city, nobody knows where he is? Those kind of, nobody would really take those kind of career risks today, and if they do, they're consciously copying him. I mean, U2 then went to Hampshire and recorded Action Baby in a kind of homage to David, but he was a risk taker, and that was what it is remains great about him.
And we're probably reveling in the anonymity a little.
I think he likes, he's into showbiz, he's into the shape of showbiz, and what is more enigmatic than just disappearing and refusing to conform and to participate, and that in itself is a great bit of marketing.
Absolutely. Yep. Paul, I was going to ask you about your other works briefly. Sympathy for the Devil, The Birth of the Rolling Stones, Iggy Pop, Open Up and Bleed, and A Portrait of the Blues. All equally enjoyable works. And how do you get started on a project like that?
Well, those projects are so daunting that I just kind of tend to attack it and get for everybody I can until once I've got the first 50 people or so under my belt, then I feel a good deal less paranoid, and I hit the road. I try and get to as many people in person as I can, and I love the thrill of the chase. For me it's a privilege. So with my Bowie book, I interviewed over 200 people, and I think it's only by getting that many opinions and exchanging with so many people, you can start to really have a feel for what somebody really is like.
Sure.
And that's the important thing to me, because actually with my books, I do have people who were there at the time, like Carlos Alomar, in the case of Bowie, would say, this was the story I know, and it feels correct. And in fact, I spent many hours talking to Carlos and listening to to the feel of how they felt with somebody, what it was like being with them, you know, what they did. And so, yeah, with a book, it's just adrenaline and controlled panic, because it's such a huge job to try and deliver something.
Sure.
And so so it's normally get the first 50 or 100 interviews and then kind of, and then go back and re-interview people until they just can't, you know, until they're, well, normally people are very obliging. I'll just go back to people again and again and again and again. And generally, you know, then people do appreciate it when they know you're trying to get the truth out of it.
And have you got a project going now?
I'm actually doing something, a couple of different things. I've got a couple of projects in development, and I don't know where they'll end up, and that's our business. And then I'm also doing something academic, so I'm doing quite a lot of lecturing, and there's something quite interesting happening there as well, because, I'm doing more academic work at a university, I hope, soon, which gets me out of the house and seeing more people, because my background is magazines, so I would tend to, you know, be quite social and see a lot of people. So just a bit of a change of pace, I think, for the next year or two, and get out and see a few more people in different places might be where I'm at. It's hard because I've done Brian Jones and Iggy and David Bowie, and they're all game changers. They, each of them, you know, changed the kind of cultural landscape, and it's pretty hard actually to find anybody else who had an influence of that magnitude. So
Okay. Paul, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been very nice talking to you. If we want to find out more about you and your writing, is there a link that we can go to?
Probably just my website, which is trynka.com, T-R-Y-N-K-A, funny Polak name, trynka.com, probably if you Google incorrect spelling, you'll find me anyway. So there's a lot of stuff about Iggy and Bowie, lots of kind of old interviews with them and photos of all the places I've been to. And then quite a lot about Brian Jones, who's the subject of my new book, which has just come out of paperback in the UK and is out in the States in a few weeks.
Brilliant. Great talking to you, man. Nice to meet you.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Genkit. Good questions as well. Thanks for that.
Bye-bye.
Take care.